This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Sports Ethos Kings Cast. It's Daily, joined today by special guest Rowan Kent, draft analyst and writer for No Ceilings, one of the top draft hubs online. Their 2024 draft guide has dropped, and it's worth every dollar, in my opinion. Rowan, how are you?
Doing great. You know, we're just a few days away. The excitement's been building year round. It's about that time. It's a two-day event now, which is really exciting, and all the hard work's just about to get the payment it deserves, and just I'm counting down the hours at this point.
Same. I'm literally reading the most random mock drafts to the big guys, whether it's a random Reddit user to, you know, the latest SI mock draft. I don't care. I'm eating everything up for no reason. First things first, what's your villain origin story? How did you become interested in being a member of the draft community?
I kind of do have maybe not a super villain origin story, but one that does make some sense. About 2 full years ago, I tore my ACL just playing sports. And for a while, much longer than that, I've had interest in the NBA draft. I've done a lot of work on my own. I've made my own boards, done my own analysis, and I really kept it close to the chest, but having a lot less time on my hands to do certain things gave me a lot more to do other things. It really pushed me out of my comfort zone to share the thoughts I had, the ideas, the takes, the analysis. And so an injury that I might look at a prospect and wonder how they can bounce back from gave me a chance to bounce back, to force myself to put this work out there. And I've always been interested in the draft side of it because the potential for so many players, prospects they have on, used to be one night, but now on two nights, it's the culmination of so much work. You can look into the really exciting and unknown future for so many teams and so many guys. So that process has always been one that I'd love to see the fruition of in this event. So yeah, that's what's led me to being in this cycle. And it's been a really great draft cycle to look at. There isn't a super top guy, and that lets you really get into the weeds on the analysis more and stake your claim on guys.
100%. And so I really wanted to get into your process on how you scout players and how you evaluate them.
But before we move on, BetOnline is your number one source for all your sports betting needs this season. From baseball, golf, soccer, right to all the top fights in UFC, MMA, and boxing. Every stat, every matchup, and even live odds and spreads while the games are being played. When the game's over, head on over to our online casino and get in on a game of blackjack, poker, or unwind with one of our over 150 slots games. Head to the website today to get in on the action. Use promo code BELIEVE, B-L-E-A-V, for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online, the game starts here.
Like, how do you define your tiers?
Yeah, I think that the tiers that I've had have been around for a few years. I think what I look for are players that can be franchise cornerstones, and that is a bit of a nebulous term. But when I'm thinking about the very top prospects that you could find in a draft class, they're only going to be a handful of all-stars or all NBA level players, looking for the traits that some guys have, the physical tools, the skills, the indicators that could make them a true team cornerstone. Each team is only going to have at the NBA level one or two guys at most, usually, that they plan so much of their team concept around. So that's the highest tier that I have. From there, a bigger tier usually is potential cornerstones, players who have a few more flaws. And in honesty, no player was in that like highest tier for me this year. There were some potential cornerstone players. I think that the quality of this draft class has been bemoaned on and on, but there's going to be players who come out of the 2024 NBA draft and do eventually reach some all-star level. There are guys that I feel somewhat more confident on who are in this tier. After that, there may be starters, higher level role players that I've seen. And those are guys where I feel confident on maybe more specific parts of the skill set. There are parts of their game that they would need to take a more marked step up. As it goes down in the tiers, it really just depends on how many NBA-ready skills, how many roles the players could fit into. And it's not just putting how versatile a player is at the top, but looking at what they could actually do and how they could grow their game.
So your second tier, the potential cornerstones, I mean, would you cap that at the end of the lottery, or do you have a specific number for this draft anyways?
For this draft and looking at how many guys that I would have in there, I would have it down to about 7 or 8 or 9. This class is a bit more fluid, so the total amount that I have in each class, I'm not going to personally cap when I am scouting how many I'm looking for in each class. If, for example, last year's draft class, Victor Wembanyama, it made a lot of sense, you know, for him to be in much more of the safe franchise cornerstone category. But there were others such as Amen Thompson and Scoot Henderson who also were there. It really depends on how many guys I see throughout the year that will fit into there. And there are a handful. I might be more on the optimistic side and be looking at the positive potentials for a lot of players while seeing routes for them to improve on their weaknesses. But I think that there are potential cornerstones in this class. There just aren't a lot of guys who have pretty clear star upside with limited questions about parts of their game.
Right. So a few years ago, this was during Jaden Ivey's year, Keegan Murray's year. You know, I watched Johnny Davis play most of Big Ten league play, and I felt comfortable in saying, you know what, this guy's an NBA player. And I'm still a Johnny Davis truther, but I'm still holding out, and I might be the only one standing when it comes to the Johnny Davis truther fan club. How many hours of footage do you log or watch before you feel comfortable assessing a player?
Yeah, in the off season itself, I usually try to look at players, probably those who return. I'll have a solid base of footage of watch that I'll have for newer prospects. I'll start with about 3 or 4 games, watching the full game to see how they're playing, both when the set is ran for them, how they're playing between possessions, to get an initial feel to start to put together a big board. I have a very rough, for example, 2025 big board that I've just started to wean down as of today. But after that, whether it's in the off season or in the early season going, getting a few more games where they're a bit more focused, maybe considering all of their drives from the previous season, looking at some of their defensive tape, that helps me to get a more complete ranking going into the preseason. And then during the season itself, is paying attention not only to the outlier positive prospect games. I think those can be really attractive data points for a lot of people, saying, what did, for example, Rob Dillingham do when he's putting up a lot of stats? Being able to look at games where players struggle can be really informative on different parts of their game that may take more of an adjustment period at the NBA level. So I might not have a total amount of hours or games, but for each guy, is getting towards the definite double digits on games for me to feel comfortable having any sort of ranking for them on a big board, because I won't put my stamp of approval behind someone I haven't watched enough to really have that strong of a take.
So, I mean, do you try to cover like the top 70 guys, the top 60 guys in your opinion, or
I go more into the triple digit guys than that. I just love to watch basketball. I think there's
right.
a lot of enjoyment I can find at any level. Last year where I was living, I was able to catch games that were in the now tattered remains of the Pac-12 or the Mountain West. I was able to see games in that way, so I could get a different perspective. I'll tune into, for example, I think it was the CBI championship where it was High Point versus Seattle University. There were prospects in that game that I was looking at, and that can be a little bit outside of the norm, but I like to look not only at that top 60, think about who could get drafted, but consider the undrafted free agents, the two-way contracts, given these are fun players to watch. And as we see, there are more and more pathways back to the NBA, whether through the G League, through international basketball. So keeping tabs on players is worth that time.
Right. And how much weight do you put on high school footage?
I think it's a really important consideration when you are thinking about an avenue for a player you might not have seen before. The roles that a player will play at each level are very different. And the higher up you go in the quality of basketball, the more streamlined and specific your role has to be. I think for a player such as Jairus Walker last year, he had a very specific role in the Houston system. He was a freshman. He was on a veteran-laden team. The responsibilities that he was tasked with, I was expected to perform on a night-in, night-out basis, were different than what he had at the high school at that summer basketball level. So going back and looking at what he can do can make you a little bit curious, can give you the intrigue of what's another level for a player to unlock that you might not see at college, but that they've demonstrated at another level and that with a few years in the NBA, they could start to bank on. So I think it is important to get as full a perspective. High school film can be at times a little fun to search around for, to dig through the bargain bin in that way. But it's fun to also see the progression of how the game itself develops by watching, for example, a finals game. And then later on, if I'm on a long flight, to put on some high school ball and see the differences in ethos and ideas.
Nice. So as far as this year's draft is concerned, like I was mentioning earlier before we started recording, I feel like there's so much movement right now at the very top. All these whispers. And I would say most of it is clickbait, right? But, you know, I'm hearing, oh, now Klingon's going to be the top pick, or Risa Shea or Alex Saar and whatnot. Any behind-the-scenes intel can you give? And if you don't want to name names or whatever, you could say, well, I heard this player is this. Are you hearing anything?
Yeah, I wouldn't totally describe myself as an intel guy yet. It's where I'd like to go. But in terms of what I have heard, the top of the draft itself, I believe enough smoke has been put there that to think about whether it's Risa Shea, whether it'll be Klingon, whether the Hawks will still feel comfortable enough to draft Alex Saar, which it wouldn't be the first time that a team has not brought in a top prospect for an individual workout, where maybe the prospect is trying to angle along with their team of people behind them where they want to end up. So the top itself has a bit more of that exciting shroud, even for someone who's a bit more plugged in. The intel that I would say is a player in Reed Sheppard has a lot of fans at high front office positions. There is consistent intel of the respect, the desire to have a player like Reed Sheppard on a basketball team. I think the reporting on his range is that in a positive way, it's pretty narrow towards the top of the draft. And I think that there are teams that have angled to trade up maybe for Houston's pick because they want to secure not only a guy like Donovan Klingon, that's the more reported name, but for Reed Sheppard as well. Alongside Sheppard and Klingon having a lot of front office fans, Stephon Castle, despite, I think, some tangible considerations, tangible concerns about what he can do at the next level, has those same types of fans where teams know that some of the picks at the top of this draft order might be able to be shaken free in comparison to, for example, last year's top pick. So there are a lot of teams that would be looking at those three players to consider trading up for. I know this might not be a super juicy nugget, but being able to think about what actual front office people have mentioned and things that I've barely heard a whisper on, those are three guys that could go towards the top and could be demanding that trade up from teams that are interested.
So with Reed Sheppard, it's the shooting, right? That's
for the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture, and the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The most attractive thing in his basketball feel that are basically allowing just his critics who talk about he's positionally undersized, the average wingspan, whatever. It's mainly a shooting that everyone's like, okay, I want him on our team.
Yeah, the shooting numbers really speak for themselves. I think the defensive tape that he put on at Kentucky back at the high school level as well, his competitive drive, the way he can fit into a lot of offensive or defensive schemes. He's not a player who you, in a good way, have to change a lot for. He's malleable and flexible on both ends. And I think that with the size, it's something that teams have looked at, but there are certain points where you simply see a basketball player you think is really dang talented, and you want to go and get them based on the stats, the behind the scenes intelligence, the interviews, the workouts. And I think that's the position that Reed Sheppard's at right now, where his entire body of work that way is in a draft where there are a lot of questions, more comfortable for teams than some other players.
Is that the same with Stephon Castle?
I think it's slightly different as far as my read on Castle. I think with Castle, there's a bit more controlled optimism. The role that he played in high school was more of a primary creator role. In looking back at that film, you can see that he's used to having the ball in his hands more. And so in the same way that Sheppard fit into that team concept, Castle really did at UConn. If he wasn't willing to have made some of the same sacrifices in his game, the team would have operated differently. The shooting with him, in the way that's a major draw for Sheppard, might be what some teams are a bit more leery about. At the same time, I think based on some of his play at different levels, there is belief that he can improve his shot, maybe more than other players who have questions about their form, their consistency, or their volume.
All right. So who are your personal draft crushes?
How many can I go? I have a lot, but
you know what? How about, you know, maybe a few in the lottery, maybe a few in the late first round, you know, just different places in the draft. How about that?
Yeah, that sounds great. I have many, so I'll try and contain myself. I think one that I personally have would be Nikola Topic. I think that he's a player that has had, no way around it, a pretty tough intel June in terms of things that have come out. It's really unfortunate, the injury he suffered. There were a lot of different people buzzing about potentially having a plus 6-inch wingspan. And upon getting that measured, it is a little bit of a negative just by about an inch. Now, I can't ignore when watching him play or looking at the raw numbers that he put up, how impactful he is as a lead ball handler. He is one of, if not in my opinion, the best pure passers in the class. The angles that he can find, the passes that he hits very casually with either hand, the way he delivers it into the shooting pocket or where only his teammate can get to it. He's able to manipulate space and find those angles while also having a really great clip when he's getting to the rim. He can get there with a lot of different, not only his burst, but his handle. And he's an acrobatic, he's a slithery sort of finisher. So while there are shooting concerns with him, he's someone that I really have just latched onto and feel that the positives can outweigh the negatives.
Yeah, no, there's more than a few Kings fans that are hoping that he drops. I don't think he will, but if he drops a 13, I would not mind, and neither would many Kings fans for sure.
And I think that even if he might have some overlap with some players on the roster, especially now that Monk is reported to be re-signing with the team, you choose talent when it's that high at different times. So I agree with you on that. Another player that is a personal draft crush would be Daron Holmes, the second out of Dayton. He is, I can't totally go as far sometimes as I want of projecting what I think he can do at the NBA level. He's a talented big who has year in and year out across his time at Dayton gotten better at things that he's need to improve on. He's become a capable shooter who has some positive indicators. It's a high release point. He might not have a high volume, but you can start to see the echoes of someone who can be a floor spacing stretch big. He's a powerful finisher. He isn't what I'd call a defensive anchor. He's not going to fully be a player that you can write your entire script of a defense around. He's a good quality weak side shot blocker. He's a tough rebounder, sets good screens, passes out of the short roll and out of the high post. There's a lot to love about Holmes, and he's someone that I've liked throughout the cycle, and it's been satisfying, not in a personal way, but to see him start to get buzz and to establish potential promises in that first round.
Now, I did have a conversation with someone, and they were set on Daron just being a center. I personally think, you know, we're moving into positionless basketball. I think he could play a little bit of both center and in a four. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that as he fills out his frame completely, he'll have the true potential to play at both of those. You have to consider who you want next to him, whether you're playing him at the four or the five traditionally. You'll want to make sure you have another player who is a bit just beefier, can absorb some of that contact so that Holmes isn't the only one who is the direct recipient of drives or post-ups at the basket. I feel that he can play those two positions at the NBA level, maybe not right away, but that he can develop.
Oh, go on. Feel free.
Let's go next to Dylan Jones out of Weber State. Dylan Jones is a funky player. There's not a better word to describe him. He is a smart, great lead guard, but an oversized sort of guard forward hybrid. He'll exit his time at Weber State as this guy who put up some career stats. He'll rank in their top five, and it came off of really consistent all-around play. He's someone who can create advantages for himself, getting defenders on his hip. He can start to expand his shooting range. It's something that he's worked on in the past 2 years as a bigger creator and as the straw that stirs the drink for that team. While there might be concerns that are valid for players at smaller schools who have to take on that type of responsibility, but then have to scale down their games, I feel a bit less so about Jones, and I feel that he can adapt that once he gets to that NBA level based on his type of play, the roles he's played before on that team. There are two more guys I'll touch on a little bit more briefly. AJ Mitchell out of UCSB is a guard that I've really enjoyed getting to watch him at times not have maybe a sterling draft season. He had to come on a bit slower due to injury, but he's a long, sort of slithering, sneaky guard. He can get to his shot. He looks like the type of guy who you feel really comfortable off your bench deploying to give you minutes running that offense. alongside him, Anton Watson of Gonzaga is a player who he's in a positive way, a jack of all trades, a do-it-all. I wouldn't even say master of none, given I think his defense is really a quality attribute. He's switchable. He's someone who you can throw on a variety of matchups. He's a really smart player who keeps the ball moving. He's shown just a little bit of that shooting potential. And he's someone that is super willing to fit himself into the roles that a team will need. So there are just a few draft crushes that I have. Are there any that you have in this draft class?
You already mentioned Daron Holmes. I really hope the Kings are looking at him. I haven't heard anything about them bringing him in, but I do hope that they're looking at him. I just think he feels that need. I don't think he's going to start or anything like that, but I think he'd be a great depth piece, and it's something that we need. Literally a stretch four, and that's what I want. So the next segment, you know, I consider it fan service. I want to talk about the latest players who have worked out for the Kings. I'll name them off right now. Zach Edey, Khalil Ware, Jameson Battle, Boogie Ellis, Ray J. Dennis, Jonathan Mogbo, Jared McCain. You know, I do know that when teams bring in players, usually it's one set that they're interested in, and then it's one set of players that they want to see them go up against who are of comparable skill or what have you. So, but I don't know who the Kings are looking at. Which player are they looking at? Khalil Ware, and they want to see how he does against Zach Edey, or is it vice versa? Who knows? If you could talk about them, their weaknesses, and maybe their main skill that they could use in the NBA, what do you think?
Yeah, I'll go down the line with some of those names you brought up. With Zach Edey, his strengths really pop off the film as soon as you see it. He has great size, really good interior scoring touch. He's a strong rebounder. He's become a better shot blocker. So a lot of the appeal comes from that immense sort of presence that he has at the basket. Places he can still improve could be his shooting and his range. You've seen maybe some footage in workouts, but that'll be something teams want to see more. He's gotten better as an athlete, but improving his ability to switch on defense is something that has become more important for centers at the NBA level. And then his playmaking is something that he wasn't generally asked to do at Purdue in their system. He was a bit more of a play finisher. I think the main skill you'll see with Edey that led him to dominate college basketball and could be something similar in different spurts of the NBA level is his size and his ability to just finish over players. You talk about advantage creation for how guys can get separation or rise up with vertical. Size can be that same kind of advantage creation with him. I think you'd want to have him as a team's starting center. You'd want to surround him with the kind of spacing, the types of defenders that would support and insulate him. And on the other hand, Khalil Ware is a center that fits a bit differently in the team concept. He has great touch. I think that it was something that wasn't seen often at Oregon, but at Indiana, he got to show off the sort of fluidity that he has around the rim, his ability to drop in things that are right by the basket, some looks that are a bit farther. He was starting to show a bit of that shooting touch. I wouldn't term it as a total skill, but it's something that he can evolve with. He got better as a shot blocker. I think that he, in a similar way to Holmes, I would not term him an anchor that you build a defense around, but he's a piece of a puzzle when you're putting together a defensive scheme. I think you'd want to continue to let him develop. You can put things on his plate early, but thinking about if you're an NBA team, if this is how much he can develop in a better context over a year, what could he see over two, over three, over four is the appeal. There are two guys on that recent workout list, which they play different general position groups, but would have similar functions at the NBA level. That's Jameson Battle and Boogie Ellis, both really prized for the shooting that they could bring. They are bigger and sort of fit in without being too undersized at either forward or guard. I think they both have some defensive concerns. You wonder how much they'd be willing to spread the ball around. But they were brought in to gauge their shooting capabilities. It's something that you'd want to see as their older players and make sure that it would be what can fit in there. They would be best served on a team getting to utilize that skill. When you're drafting, you're not drafting for what can't a player do. You look at what they can do, and both of them can shoot the heck out of the ball. Next, Ray J. Dennis. He's a talented ball handler. He's someone who transferred up, started for throughout the year at Baylor, and got to show off his not only like self-creation of getting downhill, but he was a great passer and floor general. Is what you expected from him given the massive load that he had before, but getting to see it at one of the better conferences is a really great mark for him. You'll want to see him dig in a bit more on the defensive end. Can he hold his own with bigger players, faster players, and can he shoot the ball at a higher level? So right now you wouldn't be handing him the keys outside of only a few minutes, but you'd be hoping he can keep a team's offense running in those spurts. Well, yeah, Mogbo, he's a guy who's really one that's fun to watch. He jumps off of not only like the plays he's playing, but off of the screen. He's a really dogged defender. He is aggressive. He uses his size, very handsy. He's a smart passer. He kept so much going for that San Francisco offense. He's an athletic guy, a great rebounder. He really didn't shoot many shots outside of the restricted area. So when thinking about what he can do at the next level, you would want to put him in a situation where the floor is spaced and you'd want to start to work on his shot. I think you wouldn't expect him to come in as a super talented shooter, but you're, again, not drafting for what he isn't. Finally, with McCain, shooting, on the other hand, is a really big draw for him, not only off the move, off the dribble, off of different actions. He's a really fluid mover who can get around screens. He can get to his pull-up. He's someone who showed a bit more coming downhill that was there in high school. Maybe it wasn't expected as much at Duke, but I think maybe his size at guard is a bit smaller. You'd want him to work on like putting on weight, fully spreading the ball for other players, but he's one of the best shooters in the class, and you'd want to bring him on to take advantage of that.
Back to Edie.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Like everybody who hasn't necessarily watched him, either they watch highlights or they just listen to the noise on X/Twitter. How do you feel about his so-called mobility issues? I mean, I feel like from his first year to his draft year, he's improved every year. You could see it in his physique. You could see it in his attitude. I like that he has a chip on his shoulder. So what do you make of all that?
Yeah, I think that he will have a few concerns at the NBA level. You're talking about the highest sort of pinnacle of athletes, the ones of ones who are really getting around on the floor wherever they want to get to. The windows are smaller. At the same time, you're completely right. He has improved each year. He isn't the type of stiff or plodding big man that he's somewhat had to shake the label of as he's gotten older. I think that he showed that with some of his times at the combine, being faster than expected, but also just on film, seeing his endurance level, the ability to carry that complete load of interior scoring for Purdue speaks to the fact that he's not going to need to be played just in spurts. I'm not as concerned on those mobility and those athleticism issues as I might have been even a year ago. He put in the work in the offseason. It's great to see it bearing fruit as it did this year.
So did Khalil Ware shed those motor concerns this season. My reference for him is the Pac-12 at Oregon. Sometimes he couldn't get on the floor, limited minutes. When he was on the floor, it was the most unimpressive sight you've ever seen. I just felt like there were leadership concerns / motor concerns. Did he shed all that in his season with Indiana?
Yeah, I think if you were watching the Hoosiers play, the more that you watch or maybe focusing on has where changed in those habits, he wasn't one to give up on rebounds as easily as getting to the 50-50 balls. He's working to fight through contact. So for myself, in looking at the scouting, the motor concerns have mostly been put to bed. I think that that's a really impressive developmental path too, because it's not always as easy as work on the touch with your left or make sure that you're taking off of 2 feet when you get this deep in the paint. It's a very different issue and hurdle to clear, but he mostly has done that this year.
And finally, a not so lazy comp for Jonathan Mogbo.
A not so lazy comp.
You could go lazy if you want to.
I think that comps are not always the total strength that I have. I think in an ideal world, if you're looking at what he could become, the archetype of Aaron Gordon is one that teams would be dreaming about. A really versatile defender who has that size that can sometimes slide down to the five in those lineups, makes the right play, is going to shatter the rim on a dunk coming down. I think Gordon's done a lot of great work as a shooter to quell concerns that he might have had at the college level, but that would be maybe the pie in the sky comparison that he'd have there.
Right. No, that'd be amazing if he did evolve into that. So I feel like it's a 40-60 chance that Sacramento keeps the 13th pick. So in case they do, what three candidates do you have for Sacramento?
Yeah, I think if the Kings choose to stay at this spot, they'll be feeling probably confident that there's a player who can be in the rotation. It's pretty obvious internally and externally where they want the team to be. They want to be in the playoffs. They're a team that's good enough to do so. I think the first candidate I'll bring up is Jared McCain out of Duke. They've brought him in for, I believe, at least 2 reported workouts. That's not everything. It's not nothing to see when a player does. He can fit in the system. He, surrounded by playmakers like Fox or Sabonis, will be able to get open shots. He'll do damage. He manipulates the geometry of what a defense has to guard against. So he's the first name that would stand out there. I think the next one, Tristan Da Silva out of Colorado. He's a forward who brings maybe not ideal size at either the wing or at power forward, but looking at what he did, I got a chance to see him up close and personal when the team played Colorado State. He does all the little things at a really high level. He sets good screens. He spaces the floor. He sort of floats down to that right positioning. He's someone who can fit in without needing the ball all the time. And especially for the Kings, I think Harrison Barnes is someone they might be looking to eventually, whether this or in the future, upgrade on that spot next to Keegan Murray. Da Silva is a really fascinating player to consider.
I was going to say Tristan Da Silva he's definitely a Kings fan favorite. He's also a Monty guy. He likes older players that are cerebral and very skilled. And I was able to watch him just against my Bruins. He would torch them every time. I was watching for Cody Williams, of course, but my eyes would always revert back to Tristan Da Silva just because he was always getting 50-50 balls and making tough shots. So, yeah, he's great.
Yeah, and I think that considering what Monty would be looking for, it is important to think about that draft history. I'd put together what he had done. Older players do seem to be what he targets. At the same time, with a lottery pick in a year like this, there are some younger guys like Kyshawn George out of Miami, who have enough intrigue that you can't just rule them out. He is someone who was not on a lot of consensus or at times even like sicko boards at the beginning of the year. He's improved a lot throughout his time on the Hurricanes. He's a good 6'8", legitimately. He's a quality shooter. He can create his own shot. He's slippery around contact. He has a frame that looks like he can put on more weight to fill out. He has a lot of upside. And this is a pick that I think where George will go might surprise some. I've heard his range climbing towards this range, even a bit higher. So might not be the most recognizable name, even at this point in the cycle, but is a player who could be in play at 13.
So how would you rank them, those three?
Yeah, McCain and Da Silva both fit into my board in a bit of that like starter or high level role player range. McCain comes in at 14. Da Silva for myself is coming in at 22 on my personal board. For Kyshawn George, I might be a bit lower based on some of the auxiliary features of his game. I think that he will need to get bigger, stronger. He will need to dig in more on the defensive end. He's someone that can be a really quality player, but to expect it in year one might not be the biggest recipe for success. I think he has higher upside, but in thinking about the safer projection, it would be more of a specific role player.
Nice. So what three candidates do you see for Sacramento at 45?
Yeah, all the way down at 45, there's going to be a number of players who might slip, who might be willing to sign either a two-way compared to, like last year's Trace Jackson Davis, wanting to hold out. Guys I see at 45 could be the aforementioned Dylan Jones. I think that his stock is one where I might be higher on him for my personal board. He's at 21. At the same time, I think that NBA front offices might be a little more wary of his defensive concerns. At 45, he's a type of player where you can feel confident giving him the offseason program, getting him in the system, and eventually helping him to work into being a great role player for a team. Mogbo as well is a player that we touched on already, but his range might be a little higher than 45. You never know, it can happen on draft night. And if he were to go to the Kings, he can fit really nicely as a defensive game changer. You're not drafting him to have that same usage that he had at San Francisco, but instead would be someone that you could deploy in spurts to take advantage of what he does best. It's really fun to imagine just the big-to-big passing that he and Sabonis would have. It would almost be unfair in some ways to see it. The last guy for number 45 would be Justin Edwards out of Kentucky. Edwards came in with a lot of preseason freshman expectations and hype, and it was not the year that he wanted to have. I think that there were some concerns of fit, how he would adjust to the next level. And he started to answer those as the year went on. Kentucky had a bit of an up and down year. You'd consider why are maybe their two best prospects playing off the bench. There were fascinating questions from a basketball perspective. Edwards is still a tall combo forward. He has good athleticism. He can get to the basket. He's grown as a floor spacer. He's someone who has higher upside. And if he's there at 45, you're considering players who might not immediately contribute, but who could be someone that you'll build upon and give the time to get better. You can't do too much better in that draft range for a buy low and hit on high sort of candidate.
So who's the best athlete out of those three?
The best athlete out of those three, I would say, I'll start with Jones is probably the worst of the three. It's not the big draw for him. Mogba would be the top guy. Some of the plays that he has, not only vertically on his dunks or his blocks, but his lateral quickness, his ability to move his body that way. Edwards is a good functional athlete. It's not the biggest draw of his game, but it is something that would be an above average trait for him at the NBA level.
I just feel like that's the main hole as far as the Kings. The main need is just twitchy, athletic, lengthy guys. I wish we had more. You know what I mean? If we could get like just a fraction of what the Pels have, you know what I mean? That would just help us out so much defensively. But that's a whole nother story, a whole nother episode. Who are some of your favorite second round, late second round undrafted free agent sleepers?
If you want a guy who's a twitchy, athletic player, the first guy I'll bring up really fits that. Jalen Williams out of Auburn, a 5-year player at that college level, took a bit of a backseat when Jabari Smith was there, but since was a consistent starter. He has that outlier athleticism, not only for the massive skywalking jams that he can throw down and his finishes over taller players, but he can block shots. He can easily skirt through screens. He has not only the weight and the lower body strength, but he has the upper body strength to absorb some of that contact. He's a guy that I really enjoyed digging into the further into the process I got. And he's someone that has done a number of workouts for teams that would be in that maybe UDFA range. Kevin Cross out of Tulane is another player who fits into that similar mold. He's a bit of the intersection maybe between Jalen Williams and Jonathan Mogbo because he can play a bit of that do-it-all role. He has good size for a bit of a combo forward position. He plays with a good motor. He's someone who you can task with a number of roles. He is on the older side, but at this point, the athleticism that you see from him, the consistency is important. But to veer in a whole another direction, Cam Spencer from Connecticut is a player in, maybe he's getting higher in the second round, depending on the buzz, the workouts is done, but he is just a quality player in the system that you want to run regardless of system. Being a very like scheme proof, not only offensive player, he can spread the floor, he makes the right pass, he can run a bit of the offense off of a secondary kick out on a bent defense. He isn't a physically imposing, like quick twitch athlete that we were discussing. But he's a guy who will make the right play. He's someone you can count on, and he's shown that he can keep up his pretty notable steal percentage, one of the better translating stats when looking at a defensive player at each level that he's gone up to. He's gone up in level a few times, ultimately ending up on the Huskies, and his steal rate continued. So he has a bit more defensive upside than one might presume when seeing him play at first.
So when it comes to prospects like Stephen Castle or just a prospect that's shooting maybe 33-34% from three, but you know you want them to take that next step to be a great shooter in the NBA, what's most important for you? Is it free throw percentage, volume? What do you look at to give you confidence that they're going to become the shooter that you want them to be in the NBA?
Yeah, this question was great. It really got me to dissect my own thinking and was one that was fun to parse through in the time that I've been prepping for this podcast. I think for myself, the volume that I see from a shooter is often most important to what they'll directly do. I think there can be times where an outlier shooting season comes on reduced volume. You might see a guy have a spike or dip in his percentages, but look at how many times he shot, not only in the year, but how many times he shot per game. The 3-point rate per 100 possessions can be really instructive. The consistency that players show in their form, I'm not looking for it to be picture perfect, prototypical form on a jump shot. I'm looking for the consistency, the ability to get to it pretty quickly. It can be even a set shot if the release point is high enough. So that would be what I'd look for next. And then free throw percentage is never the big canary in the coal mine for a guy to become a great shooter or to be a poor shooter, but it's an important piece of the puzzle. I think it can give you some reassurance if a player that you want to be a better shooter isn't looking like what you believe him to be on tape, or it could be a necessary pumping of the brakes on someone who might be having a sudden jump in shooting that you want to verify. So while they're all important pieces, I usually go through volume, form, and then percentage. I think you're still on mute, my bad.
Never mind. It was a bad joke. I was going to joke about Kalel Ware's like 1.4 attempts. And I feel like people just look at the shooting percentage and they don't look at the attempts. And so it's like, I feel like that's a little bit of fool's gold when people are looking at stretch bigs.
It's important. It's something that I had a chance to write a full length article about Ware this season. And yeah, it's, you can't ignore it when looking at what he can be and trying to get every different facet considered. Yes, his percentage improved. Yes, he showed burgeoning touch at the high school level. Yes, I need to see many more attempts to fully label him a stretch big.
So I'm going to throw a curveball at you. I want you to go, you know, a year back. And I wanted to know what your thoughts were about Colby Jones and Jalen Slosson.
I really enjoyed watching Jalen Slosson. He was someone who I had creeping up towards even the top 60 on my board. He played every role that you could see on his team at Furman. He was someone that had spent the time. He brought the intangibles as a veteran leader. And you might have wanted him to do a bit more as like a shooter. It might have been not his strongest suit, but I think for the Kings, he was someone that I was like, oh, that could be a really fun player to see what he can do. And for Colby Jones, I enjoyed getting to watch the work that he was putting in college as well. He was a bit of the other side of this do-it-all players archetype because his shooting was a much bigger draw in that way. He's someone who can, again, you give him the role to do and he can fulfill it on there. So I really like both of the picks. I know that they're doing most of their work at the G League level. I think that they're players who, after spending a lot of time in college, getting to then refine their games there, are maybe this year, maybe in another year of being cost controlled, could start to crack the rotation. So I was a big fan. To make a long-winded statement short of both.
No, I love it. And Colby Jones, I mean, last year, anytime he did get minutes, whether it's garbage time or he actually got a solid minutes in the first half sometimes, he would show flashes. So I'm just hoping he can become more of a role player this season. But we'll see. You never know. Last segment, this is my favorite. I've been meaning to change this, but I just like the way it is. I've been asking every draft expert this question: start, bench, G League. We're going to talk about attributes, basketball feel, physical tools, and strong skill set.
Have you ever seen the image or the GIF of the three light switches about exercise, social life, and career development, where you try and flip all three and another one gets flipped off when you try to, and you can't have them all at once? Trying to answer this in my head felt like that when I saw it earlier. So I'll do, I think obviously the cheap way out is to say they all matter and they all work intertwined, but
boo.
Exactly. So to start for myself, I do think that basketball feel, as nebulous as that is at times one of the most important things. Feel can extend to putting the right touch on a pass, making sure you have touch around the basket to finish. Feel extends to moving off ball and being in the right place, whether that's on offense or defense. Feel can extend to knowing when to really pound your dribble to get a defender on your back, when to extend and go all out. Feel is something that is not always easy to teach. And so when thinking about it as an attribute, when you think about what would be starting in this scenario that came up, a really close second would be physical tools. It's a league, the NBA is one where you have some of the best athletes in the world. Not only time basketball athletes, you have players who jump out of the gym. You have some of the fastest players, not only in a straight line, but sliding their feet. You have strong men who are playing at a breakneck pace for 48 minutes plus overtimes a night. And so it's really important, even when the wingspans come out and they might be shorter or longer, that margin of a few inches can be the difference. So things that are harder to teach in those attributes are ones that I look at and will put a bit more importance to. Putting strong skill set in the G League does feel a bit sacrosanct for the fact that these are players who are playing the game of basketball. Obviously, if I'm drafting a player to be a shooter, he needs to shoot. A shot blocker needs to block shots. It's something that I look into. And yet I myself might be a bit more of a forgiving or high upside analyst in seeing, oh, this is something that I see the outlines of, the echoes of the ability to shoot based on the feel and the physical tools for a prospect. I can feel a bit more confident projecting that out in the long run. I think that there are schools of thought where it would be the opposite, that what can a player do is the most important. My sort of philosophy prioritizes all three of these, but I think that the feel and the tools are really difficult at times to overcome if you don't have them. And skills do sometimes fit into something you can improve in that way.
Man, the way you described basketball field, that was poetry. That was good. I might have to clip that and write it down, put it on a t-shirt. speaking of physical tools and skill set, and I'm sorry, I want to get you out of here, but
no worries.
Yves Missi, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing his first name right. What's your take on him? I mean, I just feel like he's almost plug and play as far as from a defensive standpoint. And from a rim runner, vertical threat standpoint, do you think he's going to be spending more time in the G League, or is it more contingent upon where he lands?
Yeah, I actually don't know for Missi if I would put him in the G League as much. I think what's really fascinating to consider with him is he is a reclass player. He should be at like one step technically behind in where he is as level of basketball. He classed up to then start all year for Baylor to at times be a brighter star and a brighter prospect to follow than Jacoby Walter, who had come in with a lot of expectations. I see a really athletic, fluid for a big man player. He has imposing size. At the same time, you talk about a dancing bear maybe as an NFL quality for an offensive line. I think he is a bit of a balletic grizzly bear of someone who can swat shots. He moves so freely, not only getting to the rim before just finishing over or through players. He is someone who has those tools you can't teach. I think there are players who have shown bigger maybe rises in the draft process throughout the later season. But Missi's a guy who has peaked, I think, at 13 on my personal board, will finish in the top 20 at a really safe starter to high level role player place. And that might even be underselling what he can be given how young he is and where he is on his total developmental trajectory.
And I could already hear my listeners, our listeners, groaning when I ask this question, but I have to. Adembona.
I think if that's the whole question, I still enjoy and think that Bona is a player who can be a great NBA role player. He sits at 41st on my board. It must have been something in the water in Los Angeles for both UCLA and USC to have really difficult seasons. I think both teams came in with a lot of expectations, and Bona is still a great mover at center. He's someone who can set screens, roll hard to the basket, finish hard, is what you're drafting him for. He's not the type of maybe versatile big man that we touched on with other prospects, but if you're looking for a guy to back up your center, to give you the minutes that you need to just sort of put an elbow in someone, to finish through a guy, to make sure he's protecting the rim, he does have that switchability on tape. He's someone who can become not maybe a new type of player, but a really sharpened and actualized version of himself. So he still is someone that I expect to be taken on draft night in maybe that second round, or if not, to be a pretty highly prioritized UDFA.
Amazing. Rowan, this was a lot of fun, man, for sure.
Yeah, I agree. It was a blast.
So are you working on anything that we're going to be reading in the near future?
The most recent piece they had on Nikola Topic went live last Friday. It's all hands on deck with a number of live streams, live coverage of the draft. Right now, I have my own behind-the-scenes schedule for what I'm watching this summer to get ready for 2025. That might not be for public consumption, but I'm getting my first board out for 2025. But yeah, it's the culmination of a really fun year of the draft process.
Fantastic. And where can people find you?
You can find us at No Ceilings on Twitter, YouTube. You can find us across all socials. Great team of writers, myself at Rowan Kent. You'll be able to go right to those articles, those pieces, and you should be checking on the socials for the live streams for that draft coverage in the upcoming days and for reactions throughout the week and beyond.
Beautiful. We cannot wait. And Rowan, thanks again. We'll do this again sometime and have a good night.
Yeah, you as well. Thank you for having me.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.